encouragement. You can see from the very, just having it spelled out, the word courage is the chief part of the word. And then the N is to infuse courage, or to try to put courage inside someone. It, to inspire with courage, spirit or hope, to hearten, to attempt to persuade, to urge, spur on, to stimulate, to give help or patronage to foster. Now that's the English definition that Webster has. And there are several similar words with some different shades of meaning. And it's interesting that in the New Testament there is one, there are several other Greek words, but one Greek word primarily that's used, and then various forms of it, that carry with it the similar idea. This Greek word that we have on the chart denotes to call to one's side, to call to one's aid, used for every kind of calling to a person which is meant to produce a particular effect, hence with various meanings such as comfort, exhort, desire, call for, to beseech, to console is another one. You remember that Joses in Acts the 4th chapter had a certain field. He sold it, brought the proceeds, and laid it at the apostles' feet. And the apostles surnamed him Barnabas, Bar, son of consolation, or son of encouragement, some of the translations render it. And so Barnabas was this kind of person who could, as it were, infuse courage in others. Keep on keeping on. It's translated beseech some 43 times in the New Testament, to comfort 23 times, exhort, desire, to pray, and to entreat 3 times. So it has kind of a wide variety of meanings, but the main idea is the desire, the push, the encouragement, the exhortation to do what is right. And I'd like to think, first of all, with you from more of an external point of view. What is the responsibility of those like you and me toward others around us? We all have a responsibility to encourage every other person on earth to do right, not just in the confines of the East Albertville building, but actually everyone we come in contact with, whether they're Christians or not. It's our responsibility to teach the lost, teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching those you've taught and have baptized to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. And in 2 Timothy 2, Paul speaks to those who are already saved. And it's not just men, males, but all people. He said, the things which thou hast heard from me, you, Timothy, the things you have heard from me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. The word men is anthropos there, like anthropology. Mankind is the idea. So you people is just another term for it. So you can teach other people. And so our responsibility is to encourage others as well. And the responsibility surrounding assembly worship, wherein those of us who are saved are edified. You remember, we have often, and I think rightly so, emphasized Hebrews 10 verse 25, that we're not to forsake our assembling together as a matter of some. But in verse 24, let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. Consider. To provoke. Some translations have to stimulate unto love and good works. To stimulate is to encourage. That's the same idea that he mentions here. To provoke, unto a different Greek word, but the same idea. We want to spur you on to love for God, love to one another, and doing what is right. And a lot of that is done in and around the assemblies. When we come together before we meet and people ask us, oh, how are you doing? What's going on in work? What's going on in the week? What's going on in the family? And true interest is there. And then you talk, and then something comes up and you try to maybe offer a suggestion. All of those are encouraging words. Those help us. They stimulate us. And we do also, we have responsibilities and actually do some, a degree at least of encouragement in the partaking of the Lord's Supper. We do proclaim the Lord's death till He come. when you partake of the Lord's Supper and I partake of the Lord's Supper, we're basically preaching a lesson. We're saying, I believe Jesus Christ died for my sins. And as I partake of the bread and the fruit of the vine, I'm commemorating the fact that his body was given, his blood was shed. And I'm proclaiming that. That's the word Paul used. We do proclaim the Lord's death till he come. And so it's, when you do it and I do it, it's telling others, I believe I sinned. I believe the Lord died for me, but I believe he was raised and he's coming again. And through teaching and admonishing, Brother E.R. mentioned that just a little while ago relative to our singing. We are to teach and admonish one another in psalm, hymns, and spiritual songs. When you sing from the heart and sing with a great amount of fervor, and I hear your words, and I hear you singing, that's encouragement to me. Years ago I heard a fellow say he'd come to a service of the Lord's church where we were. It was years ago. And he was sitting with us toward the front, and the singing was just with a lot of volume and fervor and spirit, you know. And he said, I just thought everything was directed right toward me. And we told him, well, it was more toward the Lord, but it was toward us also, toward everybody. It was one to another. And so there is that degree of encouragement that we receive when we are in an assembly from each other. And you're singing to me and I'm singing to you, and all of us together are singing that ultimately is designed to redound to the Lord's glory, but it's good for us also. And certainly through our prayers, the same is true. When we pray, praying one for another, as James the 5th chapter teaches, all of this is helpful through the preaching and teaching. Years ago, if you just turn real briefly to 1 Corinthians 14, you good students that you are, know that Paul was dealing in 12, 13, and 14 primarily with the abuse and right use of spiritual gifts. But he uses a word throughout the 14th chapter about 8 times. The word edified is used. Notice in verse 3. He that prophesies speaks unto men edification and exhortation, consolation. He that speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but he that prophesies edifies the church. Down in verse 5, Paul said, now I would have you speak with tongues, but rather that you should prophesy. Greater is he that prophesies than he that speaks with tongues, except he interpret, that the church may receive edifying. And down in verse 12, seek that you may abound unto the edifying of the church. And we won't take all the time to read the times it's mentioned, but you get the idea that through the teaching of divine truth, the edification. Somebody mentioned a long time ago, he was asked, what does the word edify mean? He said, well, do you know what an edifice is? He said, oh yeah, I know what an edifice is. That's just a building. He said, well, that's the idea. You're building, you're being built up. And that's the idea behind being edified, built up, strengthened, encouraged, stimulated to keep on keeping on. Now, what is essential in all of these things is that we're a part of it. Brother Shane does such a wonderful job with the webpage for the church here. In fact, I don't know of another congregation that has as much good material as you do here. And he is really to be commended highly, I think, because it takes a lot of time and a lot of expertise. I'll take paper money after services, Shane. Gold, silver will. No, Shane does a wonderful job. And I wanted to commend him publicly because so many people can profit from the good that has been done here. But what I'm saying is, while the YouTube and the streaming, live streaming is helpful to people, my wife's been able to watch our services, it's not in the place of, and not instead of. And I think some people during the pandemic have used live streaming to, you know, say, well, it's just as good. I just stay at home and watch it on TV, so to speak. Well, you don't get the interaction. You might even sing along with it, but you're not edifying the people who are there. You're not asking them about the idea of virtual assemblies. Virtual means it's not real. It's not real. Now, it's happening somewhere, but where you are, you're not there with them. And that personal contact is absolutely necessary for us to receive the blessing that God intended with the instructions that He gave. So essential in all of this is a person's presence and a person's participation. As it's been said by a lot of people, worship to God is not a spectator sport. It's not a spectator sport. Everybody is to be, for everyone to get the good, everyone has to be involved. Now, having said all of that, we still are looking at the idea of our individual responsibilities to try to encourage those around us. Individual responsibilities in private, in one-on-one settings. If a man sins against you, go to him by yourself, and then you try to win your brother. If a brother be overtaken in any trespass, ye who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. Galatians 6. There are people, as mentioned in 2 Timothy 1, who had befriended Paul and were tremendous helps. And commendation, condemnation, the support, all of those things are a part of our encouraging one another. And I would say this too. In all the arrangements that God has for the church, everything that God says is calculated to try to encourage us. In the organization with elders whose responsibility it is to feed the flock. Well, that's to help the flock grow, the sheep grow, the sheep to get full of spiritual nourishment. And Hebrews 13:7, congregations are to follow the lead of the elders. And deacons are to serve the needs that are in congregations. All of these things indicate that God had in mind local churches like we have right here. And in the workings together, in every arrangement that God has, is calculated to help us go to heaven, to encourage us to keep on keeping on. The work teaching and preaching and the care of the needy and the worship in local church, all of these things are really calculated to help us, encourage us to do right. And though this kind of encouragement is divinely arranged, it comes from others. And though I may be involved and should be involved in it, but the encouragement primarily we've been talking about is designed to come, is a mutual thing. I'm trying to help you and you're trying to help me. It comes from others. But in the sense that we're looking at it tonight, it is an external encouragement. It comes from someone outside me. If, though, in several areas I should receive this kind of encouragement, and I do not receive it, or it's poorly given, what can I do? What can I do then? I think all of us, and I think from just observations now, what I know of you, you don't have really some of the problems I'm going to talk about. However, there can come, even in good congregations, there can come times in people's lives where there are particular problems that they're going through, difficult, perhaps emotional situations that they're having to deal with. And maybe some of the songs led or some of the preaching preached or teaching taught or the may not address exactly what you're going through. And it's not the Lord's fault. It's not necessarily any brother or sister's fault. It's just the way things are. But what can I do? What can I do to try to encourage myself on this? I don't believe this is the case. I think it is in some places. But if the teaching or the preaching is poorly done, and assembly worship is really not edifying, that certainly has not been the case this week. It has been edifying. But in some cases, it's not. And if no other individuals seem to care, I believe that they do, that you do here, that you do care for others here. But in some places, I've had people told me, said, Brother Phil, I think if I left, nobody ever know I was missing. Well, you know, that's not really true to start with. The Lord knows for sure, and most every congregation I'm aware of knows that. Know who's missing and who's not. But if no other individuals seem to care, or if all arrangements relative to the church, which is organization and teaching and preaching, the care of the needy, worship, if all of that is not as carried out effectively and efficiently as a person might like or might think, well, I believe I could get more out of something, as our friend told us. No disparaging remarks about brethren where she worshiped. It just, she felt like she needed to do more to try to encourage herself. What do you do? What do you do? Not everyone is what he or she is supposed to do. And God never promised that every time we would be in an assembly of worship or a Bible class or a gospel meeting that everything would be done so ecstatically in an overjoying way, overflowing way, that you just couldn't help yourself. You just have to be encouraged. He never promised that. All these things are calculated to that end, but then all... You know, Brother Yard and those of you, Brother Shane, some others of you who preached, you probably can feel it, Brother Rodney. Sometimes I'll preach a lesson, and on the way home I'll say, well, you know, what do you think of the lesson? And my wife will say, well, it was truth. And she said, and sometimes she'll say, I wouldn't use that in a meeting if I were you. And I know exactly what she means. It was true. But it doesn't challenge people's thinking to, you know, draw closer to God. Whatever, you know, in meetings you're trying to do several things at one shot. And I know exactly, and I think you do too, that those of us who try to preach and do the very best we can, you know, not every lesson is a stem winder or a barn burner, however you want to, not everyone is. And so, when they're not, and when things are not, what do you do then? I think there are two Old Testament passages that concern David that I'd like for you to think about real briefly with me. Both are in 1 Samuel. The first is in 1 Samuel 23. David at that time was running from Saul, and well, he had been for some time. But in 1 Samuel 23, there's a little verse here where Saul has wanted to kill David, but Saul's son, who is Jonathan, has been a friend to David. And I want you to notice in verse 15, that's the beginning of the paragraph, 1 Samuel 23, 15. David saw that Saul was come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in the wood. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood and strengthened his hand in God. You know what that means? That just means exactly what we're talking about. He encouraged him. He strengthened his hand in God. Well, how did he do that? He said unto him, fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee. And thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee. And that also Saul my father knows. And they two made a covenant before the Lord, and David abode in the wood, and Jonathan went to his house. Now, Jonathan was right about almost everything. Jonathan would not stand next to Saul. Jonathan would die with his father. But God had promised David that he was going to be king. In fact, it told Saul that David was going to be king. And that was one of the reasons that he was so jealous of David. But the point we're making is, on this, that I'd say, first of all, that it's extremely good for us to keep friends with those who are godly. Have our best friends, those who are godly, who want the best for you. They know you. They know maybe what some of your strengths and weaknesses are. And they will tell you and remind you of what you need to know. When you're down and you don't, and you maybe feel like you don't have the fervor you used to have, and there's some lagging in things spiritual, and you need that friend that you can count on, who you know loves you and wants the best for you, to tell you what or remind you even of things that you already need to know. Jonathan strengthened his hand in God, and he did it by assuring him not to fear. Most of the time, we are fearful over things that really don't matter in the long run. Even if it's a disease that we're maybe being tested for, what is the worst that can happen? Well, we can die. That's the worst that can happen physically. But Paul said in Philippians 1, he didn't know if he were going to die or live or die. And he said, if I live, I can enjoy the progress of your faith, share the progress and joy of your faith. But to depart and be with the Lord is far better, he said, far better. So what's the worst that can happen? Most of the time, our fears are overrated. And also, he reminded him of God's earlier promise. You will be king. You're worried about my father Saul killing you, but you've forgotten that God said you're going to be king. That means you're not going to die right now. You're going to be king. And so just to remind David of what God had earlier promised him, and things are going to work out, that he strengthened his hand in God. That's what Jonathan did. Another passage is in the 23rd chapter, the 30th chapter, just a few chapters over. This is a little later in David's life. And in chapter 30, the Amalekites have gone into Ziklag and have captured a lot of the families of some of these mighty men who were with David. David and his men are out and they come in and they see what has happened. Their families have been taken from them. But I want you to notice in verse 6, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, even some of his own people. We got to get a different leader here. For the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people were grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But look at the next phrase. But David strengthened himself in Jehovah his God. Earlier, Jonathan strengthened his hand in God. But this passage says David strengthened himself. Well, how did he do that? Keep reading. David said to Abiathar the priest, and the son of Ahimelech, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought thither the ephod to David. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, if I pursue after this troop, shall I overtake them? And God answered, pursue. Thou shalt surely overtake them, and thou shalt without fail recover all. So David took those who were with him, and that's exactly what they did. Briefly, on this point, David strengthened himself. How did he do it on this occasion? Well, he as when they came back to Ziklag and had seen how some of their families had been taken, he considered the damage that these enemies of God had inflicted on their people. And it seems like there's a righteous indignation that is brewing in the very soul of David. I've got to do something about that. I can't let these people overcome me. Have you ever gotten to the point maybe where you're kind of down, you don't really want to fight back on something that really is a spiritual matter, and you need to say something about it, you need to stand for what, and you just get tired. No, we can't let the enemies, the Philistines, so to speak, of our day, we can't let them overcome us. We've got a responsibility. And sometimes just knowing, I'm not going to personally let the enemies of God overcome something that I have some control over. I can't control the whole world, but there could be a sphere of influence that I have some power over, and I'm going to use that, wield whatever I have for good in that particular area. That's exactly what David did. And he didn't go though half-cocked, as we might say. He sought the counsel of the Lord. Bring hither the ephod. And then whatever they did with the ephod would be to seek the counsel of the Lord. And the Lord told him exactly what to do. And that's what we have to do. You know, find out what the Lord's will is on a particular matter and then determine, that's what I'm going to do. Well, that's what David did in this particular occasion. He took heart in the promises of God. God told him, you do this and you will not fail. You are going to recover these people who have been taken. Well, we don't have the ephod and we don't have the direct communication with God as David did, but we have the perfect law of liberty. We have the completed revelation of His will. And we have all we need in the New Testament. And so it's a matter of going back on an individual basis. While we have people like Jonathans in our lives who can help us and encourage us, at other times, then we strengthen ourselves in the Lord. Well, how can we do that? I want to look at 7 or 8 ways real briefly. We'll maybe try to illustrate 2 or 3 of them. I think the first thing to do is that we need to remember that God works in and through us as we cooperate with His will. The passage that we have in Philippians 2, verses 12 and 13, I believe speak to this. Most of you, I suppose, could quote verse 12 with me. So then, my beloved, even as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. But verse 13 says, for it is God who works in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure. God works through us, with us, to will and to work for His good pleasure. Through God's providence, God can use each one of us to do what is good and helpful, encouraging to others in our particular realm of activities, whether it be at school, work, various social organizations with which we might be associated or in which we might find membership. Every area, and each of us has a different sphere of influence. And God can use you to influence someone else and work through you, not in some mysterious, mystical, miraculous way, but through the power and the influence of the gospel. And as I, and with His providence moving, remember that God works in and through us. And as we cooperate with Him and His will, then encouragement can come. You may be the one who needs to give others encouragement. Rather than sometimes feeling poor, pitiful me, you know, all these bad things have happened to me, what oftentimes is a cure for the blues, so to speak, spiritually, is for us to kind of get outside of ourselves and really just focus our attention on somebody else. I've told my wife, we both talk about this sometimes, we'll see someone who has a terrible affliction, or maybe some person who's bedridden or immobile, non-ambulatory in any sense, and I'll come back and I'll say, I don't think I've got a problem in the world. Don't you feel that way? You see somebody with all kinds of difficulties that you don't have. And it could very well be, instead of focusing all my attention on me, that I need to just redirect it. And when I start asking and seeking how can I help someone else, what ends up happening is that we actually lose ourselves in someone else. And we are able to forget about some of our difficulties. And what happens is, really, it's a means by which God can allow ourselves, or allow us, to encourage ourselves. It's a psychological means by which God encourages us through ourselves and what we do. And so by our moving our attention to others, Elijah was that case. You remember Elijah had slain the 400 prophets of Baal in the 18th chapter of 1 Kings. He had them on the run, but then Jezebel and Ahab, Jezebel primarily, says, you know, this fella, Elijah, is going to be just like these fellows he slew. So she put a death warrant out on Elijah's life. And then in the 19th chapter, he's pretty down. If I can turn to 1 Kings instead of 2 Kings. In 1 Kings 19, Elijah is extremely depressed over the circumstances he he was then undergoing. And you remember down in verse 15, Jehovah said to Elijah, "Return on the way of the wilderness to Damascus, or of Damascus, and when you come, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abimelech, shalt thou anoint to be a prophet in thy room." You've got things to do, Elijah. "And it shall come to pass that him who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay." These things will happen. But then the last thing he says, "You're not by yourself. Yet will I leave me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which has not kissed him." You're not by yourself, Elijah. You think you are, but you're not. I've got work for you to do. And I believe that's a way, a means by which God really can encourage you individually by your turning your attention to others and giving encouragement to them. It works that way often. In Luke 22, 31, 32, that little section there, the Lord told Peter that Satan has asked to sift you as wheat, but I've made supplication for you. And after your conversion, strengthen the brethren. Well, here, Peter, there's going to be a real valley in which Peter will go. But he says, Satan has asked you and so on, but I've made, after you're converted, there's going to come time, I've got work for you to do. And we know the story of Peter, his denial of the Lord through the trials. But then he's the chief spokesman on Pentecost. But Peter made other mistakes, you know. In the Galatians, the second chapter, which describes what he did in Antioch, there were other occasions where Peter, we might say, blew it. But by the time he writes 1st and 2nd Peter, Peter's a changed person. In 1st Peter, he talks about how suffering can actually help us to be stronger. And then in 2 Peter, the idea of knowledge, and then he ends it by saying, "But grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." That's the last thing he says. And he was an example, a prime example, of one who vacillated, became discouraged, was on the top of the mountain, would go down, but he ends, best we know, the divine record closes on Peter by showing that he's up here with the mature. And he's encouraging everybody to grow as he had. Well, the point we're making from all that is, you may be the very one who needs to give encouragement to others, rather than sitting back and saying, "I wish somebody would visit me. I wish somebody would give me. I wish somebody would just ask how I'm doing." Well, when you come into the building, could you ask somebody else how they are doing? Could you be the one who spawns that? Surely you can. And I believe that really is a means by which God helps us to strengthen ourselves. I think a third thing we can do is read all of our Bible, but read parts when we're down and discouraged. There are parts of the Bible that can really, really help us think outside the box and think about people who were discouraged and had encouragement to keep on keeping on. The book of Psalms, in fact, some of the very time we were reading about with David a while ago in 1 Samuel 23 and 30, some of the Psalms were written during that time that he was fleeing from Saul and later Absalom. And some of the most beautiful Psalms that deal with David's expression of confidence in the Lord are seen in this. I'm just going to look at one with you. This is not on the chart. But if you'll turn to Psalm 20, it should have been on the chart, and I wouldn't be guessing around for it now. I was looking at it earlier today. Psalm 18, thank you. Psalm 18. You'll notice in the readings, the topical readings, a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord who spoke unto Jehovah the words of this song in the day that he delivered him from the hand of his enemies, from the hand of Saul. Look at Psalm 18, just a few verses. Verse 1. I love thee, O Jehovah, my strength. Jehovah is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my rock, in whom I will take refuge. My shield and the horn of my salvation. My high tower. I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from mine enemies. Cords of death compassed me, and the floods of ungodliness made me afraid. The cords of Sheol were round about me, and snares of death came upon me. But in my distress I called upon Jehovah and cried unto my God. He heard my voice out of his temple, and my cry before him came into his ears. Then the earth, and here's all kinds of figurative expressions to show how God worked through for David's benefit. The earth shook and trembled. Foundation also of the mountain quaked, were shaken because he was wroth. Then went up smoke out of his nostrils and fire out of his mouth, devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down in thick darkness was under his feet. We'll stop there. But the point is that in very highly symbolic language, David is saying, look, I was in deep trouble. I didn't know if I was going to live in these kinds of, just seems like, how in the world did that happen? But it did. And to put together, and while I mentioned on the chart, to read our Bible, particularly some passages, carefully. That is, okay, not just open it, well, this looks like a good psalm, I think of. What was the occasion on which that psalm was written? And when we can put the psalm back to the historical event in which it's couched, then what that does is it makes that psalm come completely alive to us. And we, oh yes, this is how David, this is how Jonathan strengthened his hand in God. This is how David strengthened himself in the Lord. Reading some of these psalms and trying to put them back in their historical context helps us. In Philippians, the word joy, or one of its cognates, is mentioned some 16 times in 4 chapters. And yet Paul was in house arrest when he wrote that. And rather than being down about himself, he expressed the fact that he was glad that that they had heard things were good with him, because he understood they were down about him. And Paul said, you know, in the early part of the first chapter, He said, I'd have you know that the things that have happened to me have fallen out rather to the progress of the gospel, so that the Praetorian Guard is able to know why that my bonds are actually in Christ. The reason I'm in here is because I'm a servant of the Lord. Good things have happened. And by the 4th chapter, he says, they in Caesar's household salute you, even to the very servants who were in Caesar's in Caesar's residence there in Rome. Some had become Christians. And all of the good that had been, you remember the old phrase, bloom where you're planted. There was an old song my dad used to kind of sing, and some of you who might be closer to my dad's age, not many of you are, but when I was single, my pockets did jingle, I wish I were single again. that it's almost like, you know, if I could just go back to this point in life, or if I had this opportunity in life, everything's okay. Well, that was not Paul's idea. Wherever I am, I'll just be useful to the Lord there. And sometimes when we think, if my circumstance, and the lady that we mentioned at the very beginning, the health's not all that good, work's been put on hold for her, the transportation is lacking, it just looks like bad things are happening. But she's able to talk to people and do things that she could not do. Paul had an armed escort all the way from Caesarea to Rome because of the Jews, all the machinations of all their conspiracy and what they wanted to do to Paul. It ended up, he appealed his case to Rome, had a voyage passage paid in full. He didn't have to do a thing. Romans paid it all. And then he gets there, and he has a captive audience. There were those soldiers who would be changed every 3 or 4 hours, and he was in house arrest. He had a captive audience, if you please. And good was done there. I made the point before, and I'll just make it briefly. If you'll look at Romans, the first chapter, Paul was on his third journey when he wrote Romans. Wrote it from Corinth, best we can tell. And he made a statement in the first chapter, in verse 9 and 10. God is my witness, he said. Verse 10, I make request, if by any means now at length, I may be prospered by the will of God to come to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart some spiritual gift to thee and you may be established. Paul's prayer was that he would be able to go to Rome to see them and do them good. Did he go to Rome? Yes. On a journey like the third? No. How did he get there? By being a prisoner of the Roman Empire and being escorted there. Was he able to see them? Yes. Did he do them good? Yes. And if we read the book of Philippians in conjunction with that prayer and all that God was able to do abundantly above all that you would ask or think. And so the point I'm making from all that is when we read our scriptures and try to put them in their historical context, as Paul in Philippians and David in the Psalms and others, that I'm just using these as an example, that can provide so much encouragement to me that I'm doing really on my own, but God is ultimately responsible for it. For the reading of these, praying often, brief as well as extended times. We mentioned this the other day. If we could just take, as we're driving, as we're by ourselves, we may be taking a little walk every morning or in the evening, or we're out working by ourselves, nobody's around, we can pray to God while we do that. If we can talk on the phone or text to people, we can certainly pray to God and He hears. And then at other extended times, to the point that God is like a, and I don't mean this to belittle the greatness of God, but He ought to be looked at, I believe, as a best friend we have. You know, Jesus is all the world to me, my life, my joy, my all. In that song, my friend. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends, Jesus said. And I know that God is our King and Jesus is our King. And I would never belittle the position. And yet there is a sense, as Paul said in Hebrews 4, let us therefore have boldness to go to the throne, but it's the throne of grace. And so while He is all powerful, He is also all gracious and favorable. And He wants us to come to Him. And I think if we can get to that point, it really, really helps us to have that awareness that God is always with me. He knows what I'm going through. And when we're down and out and spiritually we just don't feel like we're where we ought to be and we know we can do better, we just need to pray more and pray often, even shorter prayers, briefer prayers, but more frequently. And understand God hears me just like you hear me right now. It's helped even better. When we think about Bible characters who were discouraged in what they did, people such as Joseph, he never lost confidence in the Lord, but certainly he wouldn't know why it was taking so long for him in Potiphar's house and in prison. But Daniel and his faithfulness under duress. And Job's wife, you know, sometimes even our spouses, if they're weak or they may not be Christians and we're trying to hold the line ourselves and there's a pull this way and like it was with Job concerning his wife, why don't you just curse God and die? And his family's taken away from him, his houses, his land, all that. And what did they do? Well, they didn't give up their faith. Jeremiah was persecuted because of his faithfulness, because of his preaching. But he didn't lose courage. He did not do that. I think the memorization of some hymns, good hymns, substantive hymns that we might read. I know some who during the Lord's Supper, there may be a particular passage, there may be a particular song that it's extremely meaningful, and just to mull over the words is extremely helpful to help us concentrate. And oftentimes a song expressing ideas in a poetic way can be extremely powerful. It's been said by some, if they could control the songs of a nation, they could control a nation. There's a lot of truth to that. We learn our ABCs. Sometimes we'll learn the books of the Bible by songs. They seem to imprint it more in us. And the same is true with the memorization of hymns. I think we can listen to singing, listen to other classes, listen to there are so many podcasts that are available now. And read articles online. And again, I'll plug your own webpage. You have a host of wonderful articles and good sermons from years gone by preachers who are gone on to meet their reward that younger people can listen to one every week, perhaps, and be edified by that. And the last point I want to make is this, and this refers really back to what I was mentioning relative to prayer, and that is that I think it helps me to know that God is always with me. God's constant presence is here. Our brother Sid prayed, and I noticed he mentioned it several times, God, please be with. And he mentioned some of the sick. Be with me, Brother Philip. Several times, be with. And that's a good phrase. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world, Matthew 28:20. The Lord is with us. Now, what does that not mean? It doesn't mean that God keeps every problem physically from happening to us. That's not what it means. If God is really with us, we're not going to ever have a traffic accident. We're not going to ever have cancer or some other disease. That's not what it means. But He is with us, and He knows what's going on with us. He supports us. We do know in 1 Corinthians 10 that there is no temptation taken you but such as common to man. And God is faithful, who will with the temptation make also the way of escape. So that tells me this, that God is with me to the degree that providentially there's not going to come anything in my life that I can't say no to, and I just have to throw in the towel. I can't help it. No, I can say no, I can mean it, and not fall into whatever trap that may be, whatever sin, whatever problem that is. I can say no. I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me. Philippians 4 verse 13. How can I do that? I can know the Lord is with me. His arrangements are for my good. That He's listening to my prayers. That He's answering my prayers in what is always best for me, even though I might not know how it all comes. As I've gotten older, there's a song that means so much more. I didn't ask to have it put. Number 72, if you'll turn to that number with me. Be with me, Lord. I cannot live without Thee. I dare not try to take one step alone. I cannot bear the loads of life unaided. I need Thy strength to lean myself upon. If dangers threaten, if storms of trial burst above my head, if lashing seas leap everywhere about me, they cannot harm or make my heart afraid. And then notice the third stanza. Be with me, Lord, no other gift or blessing Thou couldst bestow could with this one compare. There's no other blessing, no other gift God could give that could compare with this one. What is it? A constant sense of Thy abiding presence. To know that wherever I am, God is there. He's with me. He's with me in times of discouragement. Let's sing the third stanza together. So when we think about that, that God is not very far from each one of us, as Paul said to the Athenians, then that can help me be encouraged. Pardon the personal reference, but back during when the pandemic and the restrictions really began hot and heavy in March of 2020, my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, was really dying. She had some problems, and she was not well, and she'd contracted pneumonia, and she was aspirating. And she came home from the hospital with hospice, which was not necessary but for about 12 hours. But the last two or three times my wife had seen her in the hospital, then there at the house before she left, she said to her mother, she said, "Mama, I'm not going to be able to be with you, and I don't know who all will be." But she said, "Always remember, God is with you." And he was. And you think about when David said, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff comfort me." God is with us as we go through difficult times. He is with us when we depart. And as the song says in the fourth verse, "To worlds unknown, O Lord, be with me there." Well, you've listened patiently, and I hope our thoughts have been helpful. Encouragement comes from others as well as from ourselves. Ultimately, though, it's all from God. And His design for all of this, for our encouragement, for everything that we do, really, is for our salvation. And it's possible for each of us if we work with Him. He will work with us. Is there a person tonight who needs to obey the gospel and to start the walk with God? Isn't it a wonderful, it's the only walk you can have that's worth anything, that will end at God's throne? You can come to the front. Brethren will help you hear your good confession and be baptized in water. If you've not done that yet, we would wish you would tonight. And if there's something amiss in life where you maybe have been discouraged to the point that you've sinned, discouragement itself is not necessarily a sin, but it can lead to sins. And if you've allowed that to happen and you want to be, pardon the pun, but kick-started, you want to get back. And I am resolved no longer to linger, charmed by the world's delights. Things that are higher, things that are nobler, these have allured my sight. And brethren can help you and pray for you and with you as you repent. If we can help you, come to the front as together we stand.